Hi, this is Conrad Marshall from Good Weekend Talks, and we have two episodes for you this week. On Friday, we take a hard look at Malcolm Turnbull's new memoir, and on Saturday, we revisit the Spanish flu pandemic. So after this episode of Please Explain, go and search Good Weekend Talks wherever you get your podcasts.
From the newsrooms of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain. I'm Tori Maguire and it is Monday, April 20. For the duration of the COVID-19 crisis, Please Explain is coming to you 5 days a week. As of this afternoon, Australia has recorded 6,617 cases of coronavirus and 71 people have died. Yesterday in Australia, just 45 new cases were reported. I'm joined now by National Security and Foreign Affairs correspondent Anthony Galloway. Welcome to Please Explain, Anthony.
Thank you. Great to be here.
I want to start by asking you about the various theories about where the COVID-19 virus came from. Is there anyone credible here in Australia or anywhere else suggesting that the virus originated anywhere other than in the wet market in Wuhan?
Well, there are starting to be credible reports out of the US intelligence community, and they are assessing whether the virus, in fact, started somehow in a Wuhan lab and then made its way to the wet market. So there's no suggestion that the outbreak didn't begin in a wet market, but the Trump administration is now assessing a number of reports about how it perhaps arrived at the wet market. And one of the possibilities it is seriously looking at is whether it started in a Wuhan lab somehow. Now, that could be a worker who didn't wash their hands properly and then went to the wet market and spread it that way, because we do know authorities there were studying different coronaviruses. So there are credible reports that that is a possibility, but anyone that suggests that any kind of determination has been made by the US intelligence community into this is wrong. It's one of many possibilities they're looking at.
It would certainly escalate tensions between China and the rest of the world if anyone was able to seriously suggest that they were lying about the origin of the virus.
Exactly. I mean, we already know Beijing wasn't completely forthcoming throughout late December and pretty much all of January. If we came to a determination that was fairly solid, that it did originate in this lab and that it'd been hiding that fact from us, that would be a major development. I think some people are conflating the possibility that it originated in a lab with biosecurity warfare somehow, which is a whole nother step you have to take, and there's just no credible report that Chinese authorities went there in any way. And I mean, a lot for that conspiracy to be true, a lot had to go right for China. I mean, they had to start a major pandemic in their own country, contain it within Hubei province, and then somehow let it get out as well and not ravage their own country and ravage the rest of the world. It's not a very credible conspiracy, I should say. And it wouldn't fit with the types of actions that Beijing has taken previously.
The Trump administration in the US is not known for being particularly measured or necessarily sensible about rhetoric on these kind of things. Is China getting offended and upset by the suggestions that they lied?
They are, and they are fighting back throughout the world and when any kind of accusation is made about them not being forthcoming in the early stages of the virus outbreak. I mean, you've even seen overnight Maurice Payne's comments on Insiders on Sunday, where she said there has to be some kind of global review into the pandemic, and China and the World Health Organization's response would have to form a major part of that. And they've made comments, you know, criticising Australia overnight. So they are very attuned to this and looking to kind of fight back against any accusation.
Talk us through the issues with the World Health Organization. Many credible people do claim that the WHO is beholden to China and therefore that influenced it being slow off the mark in declaring this a pandemic. What's the latest on our relationship with the WHO? The United States have pulled funding. What's the Australian government position?
We quietly lost faith in the world headquarters of the WHO probably in the last week of January, and we really stopped parroting their advice, which Chief Health Minister Brendan Murphy, you know, was doing to an extent for all of January, repeating WHO advice. Starting in the last few days of January, he stopped doing that, and a decision was made by Murphy that he could no longer completely trust what Geneva was telling him and telling the Australian government, because it was just uncritically repeating lines from Beijing. Now, the most notable example is, you know, a WHO tweet on January 14th saying there is no evidence of human-to-human transmission of this virus. At that stage, there wasn't anyone who was closely following this that kind of thought human-to-human transmission wasn't happening. So the Australian government got quite sick of saying something and then that turning out to be wrong a few days later. And so a critical kind of date was February 1 this year, where the Australian government made a decision to ban all travel from mainland China against the advice of the WHO, and the WHO actually criticised them for this, along with Beijing. And from that moment, we never really, we started making assessments based on our own health advice and never kind of looked back.
So what is the hold that China has over the WHO?
Well, you can look at like some simple facts. They've had a essentially their candidate in since 2006. So the former Hong Kong health minister was in from 2006 to 2017, I think. And then the latest director general, Tedros, has been in since then. Now, he's not a Chinese national, but he was Beijing's candidate, and he prevailed over a British and US-backed candidate in 2017. So they have had their person in charge of the organisation since then. And so what we're really starting to realise, the international community is really starting to realise, is we've probably been asleep at the wheel. Beijing has been quietly exerting a lot of influence over these UN specialist agencies for quite a number of years. And it's really invested its time into the agencies that actually do stuff, like the World Health Organization. And while we've probably been preoccupied with some of the more notable UN bodies, like the UNHCR, which posts a lot of advice, makes a lot of statements, but doesn't actually do things, and isn't as important in a crisis as the WHO is.
It's an interesting representation of how years of investment in soft power can have a huge impact, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I mean, the US funding, I mean, up until Trump's pulled the funding, but we'll see how long that lasts, actually dwarfs China's for the WHO, for example. But they've really been astute in pouring their resources into key votes at the UN to get their candidates up into the bodies that they've specifically focused on. And, you know, they've left other bodies that they haven't focused on within the UN. But there's 15 specialist UN agencies like the WHO, and Beijing has four Chinese nationals in charge of four of them. And they're the four that they really think are important. So take the Department of Economic and Social Affairs. They've had a Chinese national in charge of that since 2007. What has that allowed them to do? Well, it's allowed them to mold the Belt and Road Initiative in with the UN's sustainable goals. And that way, it's brought an element of credibility to the BRI scheme, which it otherwise wouldn't have.
So speaking of soft power, it's no secret or surprise that China has been very active in the Pacific. That all may have come to a slight head in Vanuatu last week, when an Australian plane full of aid after the cyclone that hit Vanuatu wasn't able to land because a Chinese plane was on the tarmac. What happened there, Anthony?
It's a really bizarre story. And I mean, what exactly happened hasn't been determined by Australian authorities, but a Chinese plane that arrived on the Saturday, for some reason didn't unload on the Saturday. The the crew on board went in and checked in at the Holiday Inn in Port Vila in Vanuatu, and were continuing to unload on the Sunday when a raft plane was due to arrive. The raft plane saw the Chinese plane was on the tarmac, or was alerted that it was on the tarmac, and was continuing to circle the airport for quite a lot of time, waiting for this plane to unload. It still hadn't unloaded in time. The raft jet reached its fuel limit and had to fly all the way back to Brisbane, and then had to make the same trip again the next day on the Monday to deliver this aid for the cyclone. Defence officials that I've spoken to on background have not ruled out that this was an intentional act by the Chinese plane. It was chartered by a Chinese state-owned company that has quite a large presence in the Pacific. They're not saying it was definitely an intentional act, but the situation is bizarre enough that they haven't ruled that out, and neither did Maurice Payne when she was questioned about it yesterday.
These sort of games are not helpful, are they, when everyone is already struggling to deal with this global pandemic crisis? The people of Vanuatu just need their aid.
Exactly. And look, the Chinese plane was carrying medical supplies, PPE, to deal with any outbreak of COVID-19. They haven't had a single case yet, but there's great fears for countries like Vanuatu who would not have the health systems to cope with any kind of outbreak of the coronavirus. So they were delivering important kind of equipment that they need, as was the raft jet. And the fact that we can't even coordinate enough with the Vanuatu authorities and perhaps the Chinese authorities to arrive on separate days and unload a plane speaks to the perhaps the level of distrust that at the moment between Australia and China.
I was just about to say, as my final question to you, Anthony, how do you rate the health of the Australia-Chinese relationship at the moment?
Oh, it's not good, but I mean, starting in about mid-2017, we had an active shift within Canberra that we were no longer pursuing a kind of a relationship built on mutual trust between Beijing and Canberra. We made a decision to be perhaps a bit more strident in our criticism because we could see what China was doing in our region and around the world, and we didn't like it. And I'll just point out that over this last 3 years where Australia's been in the diplomatic freezer with Beijing. I mean, the only minister that's been able to get a high-level meeting is Simon Birmingham, the trade minister. Scott Morrison can't get a meeting with Xi Jinping, and Maurice Payne's had her issues as well. Over this time, trade's actually gone up. It's at an almost all-time high. It's still hovering around about 40% of our exports. So there's no direct correlation between bad diplomatic relations and a bad trade relationship so far. So an assessment's kind of been made within Australia that we can perhaps be more stringent in our criticism and still maintain a pretty healthy trade relationship.
Anthony, thanks so much for joining me on Please Explain. We will check back in with you later on in this crisis.
Thanks so much.
Today's episode of Please Explain was produced by David Escort and Amelia Maguire. The journalists, editors, photographers, producers and tech team at The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald are working tirelessly at the moment to cover the COVID-19 crisis factually, fairly and comprehensively. For coverage you can trust, visit our websites or buy our papers. To support our journalism, you can subscribe via our homepages or just search subscribe, The Sydney Morning Herald or The Age. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.